up the hand of a girl I love. You tell me I'm not.
Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. Today's guest, Norman Putnam, and I spoke on the phone for over an hour, and maybe I'm wrong. You'll let me know, but my feedback in the past has been from listeners that they reach a saturation point after a while. So I have to edit the interviews down sometimes when they're not live on the air, and I try to pick something that works as a theme or stuff that is that I think is the most interesting, stuff I'm the most interested in. But there's a lot I had to cut out here with Norman. His new book, which you talk about here, it's very easy reading. It's all written in these kind of short chapters. Each has a little bit of a subject matter, and you can just pick it up and put it down as you like. It's easy reading. But we don't get to hear about his production almost at all. He produced Dan Fogelberg, and there's some funny stories about his expense account work while recording New Riders of the Purple Sage. He also produced Margaritaville, one of the biggest singles ever. So anyways, Norman Putnam, go buy the book. I hope you'll find this interesting, and some interesting stuff coming up. So check WFMU.org/Michael. Talk to you soon.
And I'm never gonna let her go. Love I've ever had. Maybe I would, oh, but I love her so. I'm never gonna let her go. You better move on. You better move on. You better move on.
Norbert Putnam joins us this morning, and he's just put out this book that we've been talking about called Music Lessons, Volume 1, a musical memoir, and I'm just thrilled to talk to him because, as we've heard this morning, lots of great music involved in this guy's really long career. You grew up in the Muscle Shoals area, is that right?
That's correct.
So growing up, what did your folks do?
My father, as a young man, attempted to be a musician. He played the acoustic bass in a family band, but by the time he was in his late teens, he was on Bill Street in Memphis, playing the bars and the clubs. And he didn't like that. He came home, got into the insurance business, and his dream was for me to complete college, get a business degree, and join him in Putnam & Putnam's insurance agency. But that didn't happen.
But you did dig out his old bass, and so you did follow him just in a slightly different way. What motivated you to grab his old bass?
Some kids in my neighborhood, and I say that because we went to different schools, had put together a band to play early Elvis music. When it was Elvis with Scotty and Bill, and Bill was slapping the bass. One of the kids remembered that my father had an acoustic bass. No one else in school had one. And so I was drafted.
So just having the bass was automatic entry into the band.
Well, I asked Danny Cross. I said, Danny, what makes you think overnight I'll become proficient enough to play in your band? And he said, well, Norbert, this Elvis stuff only has three chords. Surely to God you can find three notes, he said. And I thought, I'll bet I can.
So we're talking about 1957, something like that, and you were, I don't know, about 15 years old or so,
15,
is that right?
I was 15 and actually 55, so I guess I was still somewhere between 55 and 56 when those first Elvis records are really starting to sell,
And is this band going out and playing gigs?
Well, in the beginning, we played sock hops around the school, at the high school, and we would play a July 4th political event, and at Spring Park here. And we would play Elvis, Carl Perkins. David Briggs joined the band, and so now we can do Jerry Lee Lewis, okay? And so that was the first music we played between the age of 15 and 16. But then we met Jerry Kerrigan, who was a drummer here in Florence. And his dad was putting together a band to play the music the college kids loved. And it wasn't Elvis. It was James Brown. It was Bobby Blueblatt. It was Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. It was Ray Charles, Hit the Road, Jack, and What Did I Say? That music, you know. So at the age of 16, I pick up a Fender bass and join up with the Kerrigans, and we switch over from Elvis to playing the music of the South, you know, of Ray Charles and the R&B music.
I'm a fan of both kinds of music, but it's sort of a huge world away and a huge world from kind of slapping the bass Scotty Moore style to the kind of in the groove, in the pocket Fender style. Did you even think about that at the time?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was really difficult. I was a klutz on the Fender bass for about a year before I really figured it out. And the other thing was the music wasn't three chords. You know, Ray Charles was atonal. He was using everything in the book in a chord progression. So not only were we leaving, Elvis's music was basically country music with a rock twist, you know. And the blues, the blues is not that far from it. But when you did Ray and when you did Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and James Brown, the music got more interesting and more complicated, you know.
Yeah, so I think this band was called the Mark Five, and Frat Party seemed to be the kind of bread and butter of that band. I can only imagine in the late 50s, early 60s, what frat parties were like. What was it like?
Well, these college kids had left home, gone down to the University of Alabama or Ole Miss, and gone completely crazy, okay? The frat parties were drunken brawls, basically. There'd be fights. There would be people that would throw up in the middle of the floor. It was debauchery on the college level, at least to a kid who's 16 years old, you have to understand. You know, I couldn't believe these kids because they were only a few years older, but they were totally nuts. You know, they would be drinking from a bottle of bourbon, and they'd be taking swigs of 2 or 3 ounces, and it was an education. It was my first music lesson, as I say in the book. but the music was a lot of fun. And that music sort of trained us to play on the first hit records down here. Because also at the age of 16, we meet Tom Stafford. And Tom has a little publishing company here in Florence, Alabama. And Tom is the manager of the Prince's Theater. He's 10 years our senior. He's this older guy. You know, he must have been 26. And he drafts David Briggs and I to come and play on demos for his little publishing company. And he was like Robert Preston in The Music Man. He was saying, right here in Florence, Alabama, we're gonna write hit songs, we're going to cut hit records, and we're going to become a recording capital. So we assumed he was obviously delusional.
Yes, in the book you have a whole chapter where you call him delusional, but he sort of was, even though he never sort of got that hit record. He did sort of start the ball rolling for Rick Hall. I mean, is it right to say that without Tom Stafford there wouldn't have been Rick Hall?
Absolutely. I call him delusional. That was just what we thought in the beginning. 2 years later, he proves us all wrong. Okay. Because a young man named Arthur Alexander came up the steps to the studio, this little mono studio where we did demos. And Arthur had good songs. And Arthur had a great voice, okay? And suddenly, in the beginning, Rick would, Tom would sign anybody who could make a rhyme. And so the songs were awful. The people couldn't sing. Well, I got to tell you another thing. We're all trying to learn how to play an original part on an original song, okay? And this is a change because I stole every bass part I ever played in the Mark V off the record. And so without Tom and the training we received up there, we wouldn't have been ready when Rick Hall shows up. And so now we're about 18, and we've been doing demos on Arthur. And up the steps one day comes Rick Hall. And he ends up making a deal with Tom Stafford, and a month later, Rick, who was the first real entrepreneur for the music business here, he finds an abandoned warehouse, puts together some used recording equipment, and we go in there and record the first nationwide hit, Arthur Alexander's You Better Move On.
Let's talk about Arthur Alexander, because he continued to write great songs until he sort of retired or went away or got disillusioned. But did he just write the songs in his head? Did he? Because he had a very, you know, it's a very instinctive. Those songs are very, they're so easy. You know what I mean? They just exist.
Well,
they don't seem labored.
He actually crafted the lyric very well, and I think he did that naturally. Because, you know, he couldn't play an instrument. He would come up to Tom Stafford's, and he would stand and sing us the song a cappella with a lyric sheet. And then David Briggs, I have to give David Briggs credit for this. David would say, come out to the piano, and I will try to find the chords you're hearing in your head. So Arthur would go out there with David, and we'd leave them alone. And Arthur would be singing, and David would be trying this chord and that chord. And Arthur would say, no, that's not it, that's not it. Oh, that's the one. That's the chord. And so it would take David Briggs 20, 30 minutes to find all the chords Arthur was hearing in his head. And then we'd all go out, and David would prepare a chart, and we would all play the song.
All right, I want to move forward to the Beatles. 1964, Tommy Rowe says he'd played on bills with the Beatles and, in fact, was trying to get folks in America interested in signing the Beatles. And, of course, everyone thought he was crazy. But finally, they come to America, February 1964, and he says, hey, we're going to go play on a bill with the Beatles in Washington, D.C., and you get to go in this band. And you, to start with, if I remember reading the book, you weren't the hugest Beatles fan from what you initially heard. Is that right?
Well, Tommy came back from Germany, and he was raving about the charisma of this band. And he said, he's talking to Felton Jarvis, the producer. He said, Felton, you should sign these guys because they've got something. Yeah, Tommy's record was in the top five in Germany at that time. And Tommy said, I could hardly follow these guys on stage. The crowd went berserk over these guys, and they're just doing cover songs. And he'd come back with a tape. McCartney had handed him a tape, and it was a mono tape made on one microphone, probably in a hotel room. And Paul is playing the acoustic guitar and singing one of their songs. And when it got to the chorus, obviously John and George fall in. And we listened to it, and it was pretty bad. It belied everything he said, because when Paul started to play the guitar, the B string was flat. It was out of tune. And we all looked at each other like, well, the guy can't tune his guitar, you know. So that was one demerit. And then the song was rather trite. It had a commonplace chord progression and that had been used on 1,000 songs. But the killer thing was when they got to the chorus. And I told this story to George Harrison in the mid-70s, and he fell out laughing. I said, George, when it got to the chorus, you and John lean into that one mic. The three parts were so out of tune, Rick Hall just reached over and hit stop on the tape machine. And that was the end of the Beatles. Can you imagine? And a year later, we get the call. And they call Tommy, want to know if we'll come up. Well, we weren't so sure, but they were paying a lot of money, okay? And but we were excited about the fact that one of the six opening acts was the Righteous Brothers. Ah, it never got any better than the Righteous Brothers, you know? And so we went up there to Washington, excited about playing with the Righteous Brothers, not so excited about seeing the Beatles until we heard them play that night. And a light went on, okay? A bell rang out. It was a seminal moment for me and David Briggs, because we stayed at ringside. And I say ringside because the stage was a boxing ring placed in the middle of this arena that was more like an ice hockey arena or a basketball arena, you know? And when they hit that first chord, first of all, the big Vox amps they had was a technology that was well beyond our American Fender amps at that time. It was the Maxell tape pad, okay? They were so loud, it blew your hair back. And it was exciting, and it was stupendous. And the crowd was going wild. And before David Briggs and I knew what we were doing, we were right there with him, you know. And so, once again, we misjudged another great act.
You know? But it sounds like it's kind of opened your mind a little bit.
Oh, well, David and I think that moment was when David and I decided we'd leave Muscle Shoals and go to Nashville. Nashville had more rock acts. Muscle Shoals was doing a lot of good R&B, but there wasn't any chance that Elvis Presley was coming down here anytime soon, you know, or Roy Orbison, or all the people we played for when we got to Nashville. And so it turned out to be a great move on our part, even though it required a lot of woodshedding, because those Nashville guys, the old pros, in 5 to 10 minutes, Floyd Kramer and Buddy Harmon and Bobby Moore, these were the guys who backed up Elvis in the early days. They would have a killer track happening in 5 or 10 minutes. So we had to kick up our act down here from Muscle Shoals. In Muscle Shoals, we'd take an hour to 3 hours sometimes on a track, you see. So we go to Nashville, and we've got to get our sight reading together, because a few years later, I'm playing with Henry Mancini, working with Al Hurd in a 50-piece orchestra, and I'm playing acoustic bass as much as I'm playing Fender bass. We actually became great musicians when we got to Nashville.
Because you sort of had to get good fast. I mean, I think that's real crucial, because Rick Hall had the style where you would just keep playing till you got it right, and Nashville had this very much union session thing, very, you know, this clockwork kind of way of making records. Did you get accepted by the old crowd there right away, or was there resentment? Who are these new kids from the middle of nowhere?
Believe it or not, we had a lot of assistance from the old boys. And there were many times Harold Bradley would really save me. If I was playing a country date, that was music I knew least about. I would turn to Harold and I would say, Harold, if you hear me play anything stupid on the rundown, because we would play it once before we recorded it, kick me in the shins. And many times Harold would say, Norbert, that thing you're doing going into the chorus, don't do that, do this. And he would play a bar. And I would reach up and sketch it onto my arrangement, okay?
Let me remind everybody, Norbert Putnam is our guest, and the new book is called Music Lessons Volume 1, A Musical Memoir, and I super, super enjoyed it. There's a great, funny story in the book about Chet Atkins, who's kind of, his style of producing is kind of hands-off, we can say.
Yeah, you know, that was pretty much the way all of them would approach it to some extent. First of all, I would say the top four guys, it took me 3 years to make it into the top four most called bassists, right? But once you were in the top four, you could work 20 dates a week. But the top four guys, these guys were geniuses, okay? There wasn't, you would be a fool to walk over to one of them and say, hey, I've got a part for you. Would you play, you know? And Chet knew that, Oren knew it, all the top producers. Chet Atkins would tell us where to play. He would say to Floyd Kramer, Floyd, I want you to take the intro on this, and Grady Martin, would you fill the two bars on the first ending going back to the second verse? And Pete Drake, slide into that chorus and give us a little something. Anita Kerr Singers, bar 9 of letter A, would you give me a four-part tight try it? Well, he did a four-part thing on the piano. Anita had perfect pitch. I would see her writing it out on her music score paper. You know? So these were serious musicians up there.
Was it always with the singer singing the vocal live, or was it just the track?
Yes. When I first went up there, Owen Bradley, he spent a little time with me, and he said, kid, I'm going to make you third bass at Decca. Oh, this is great. This is a guarantee of a lot of work, okay? He said, you understand what we do. And I said, well, I don't. I said, I assume you want me to play great bass parts. No, he said, what we do is we accompany singers. He says, 99% of your day, you're going to be walking in the studio and accompanying a vocal. And he said, we're very careful how we treat that. You are to play to the emotion of that voice. And when that voice gets excited and brings it up, the whole band brings it up, you know?
So in addition to these amazing and prolific country sessions, you did do a lot of pop records in Nashville, and I think not everybody knows that was the case, but folks like Neon Philharmonic and Tony Joe White's hugest hits and Monkees records and Bo Bremel's and Linda Ronstadt and Bobby Goldsboro and Bobby Russell and Henry Mancini and the New Beats and the Vogues. So like Vogue's 5 o'clock world, New Beats, Bread and Butter. Those were just 3-hour sessions that you got called for?
Oh yeah. And we probably did 4 songs in that 3 hours. One of which was, what was the Vogue's big hit?
5 o'clock
World. 5 o'clock World. Yeah, a young songwriter had come over from Memphis. His name was Alan Reynolds, and he worked at a bank, and he'd written this song. And it was actually done as a demo for Screen Gems. And he played it down. We wrote it out. We quickly did a track. But the Vogues weren't there. It was a Nashville guy singing. Well, it might have been Alan singing. Okay. And then we did 3 or 4 other songs from other writers in the 3 hours. They sent the song to the Vogues, and they tried to cut it in New York, but they couldn't get the feel we had on the demo. So Tony Moon, who produced for Screen Gems, sent the track up, and they simply put their voices on it. You know, That I think that was the first hit I played on after we came up from Muscle Shoals. And I'm playing the acoustic bass on there, too.
So the typical busy day for you, was it, you know, 4 sessions a day? I mean, was that typical for you when you were in your prime of doing sessions?
Well, by 1970, that's my 5th year. I think I did 624 record dates that year. And I was an exhausted young man. and I was sort of looking for a way out, okay? And David Briggs and I, who was my partner from Muscle Shoals, we met at the age of 15. We decided we'd buy a little house and become famous songwriters. Now, we could make $100,000 a year by 1970 going down to the Nashville studios, okay? That was a lot of money then, okay? That's a lot of money now, as a matter of fact. But David decided if we could write 2 hit songs a year, we could make $100,000. And we wouldn't have to play. See, I'd leave home at 9 in the morning and come home usually at 10 in the evening or 2 a.m. Same was true for David and most of the top-tier guys, you know. So we buy a little building, and we're going to put in a 4-track, and Elliot Mazur comes in, New York producer, who's about to do Linda Ronstadt down there. And he said, guys, if you put in some decent gear, I'd love to record in this little room. And he sort of talked us into adding the equipment necessary to make Quadrophonic Studio a great studio. And that same year, I produced my first hit record, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, on Joan Baez. Because Chris Christopherson backs out. He was to produce
that. And so you got the job. There is a lot we have not talked about, and I want to urge folks to get the book to kind of fill in the missing parts of your career. But one thing we have to talk about is Elvis Presley. You played on over 100 recordings with Elvis between 1970 and when he passed away in 1977. And one of the things about Elvis is that they've released every scrap of tape there is, just about. So you can really hear how tracks got built up and how the band changed, you know, tried different things on different takes and how things kind of got built up. And you can hear the in-between song chatter and stuff. And it sounds really like musician's paradise because it's super fun. And he's joking. He's always joking around, always. And in between tracks, everyone seems remarkably relaxed for a guy with such a huge, you know, force of nature, you know. But it just sounds like it was really awesome making those records.
Well, it was. And Elvis had so much fun with us. He loved the fact that we could write it out in 5 minutes and play it back to him. I don't know if he'd ever worked with a rhythm section as quick as we were. A lot of times, Chip Young would start playing some Chuck Berry riff. And Elvis would say, what song is that? Well, it could have been any of the Chuck Berries. They all had the same sort of guitar. And Elvis would say, well, let's do Old Carol, or let's do Promised Land, or let's do... And he'd say, Felton, turn on the tape. And literally, we might play it down once or twice before we had a completed record. Presley was, he was focused is the only thing I can say about him. He was highly skilled and highly focused, and when he decided he was ready to go, he never worked his way up to the vocal he wanted. He started at the top.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's the guy who really got you to pick up, literally pick up the bass in the first place, and then here you are, you know, it's just mind-blowing.
Well, you know, that first week I worked with him in 1970, towards the end of the week, he came over to me and he said, "Pud, how did you get started?" And I told him that story about Danny Cross and my father's bass and how Danny said, "Well, this Elvis stuff only has three chords. Surely to God you can do that." And you know, Elvis leaned back and he said, "You know, if I'd been Sinatra, you would have never figured out the changes to the first chorus." I want to tell you, Presley was a very bright man, you know.
Yeah, well, I think people, for, you know, his force of personality is so huge that people lose track of how talented he was and just how unique and great, just amazing singer and just loved music, you know. And that's so clear when you listen to all these sessions. There's so much in the book that, you know, there's your time with George Harrison, and there's just all kinds of stuff that if folks want to check it out, they should. Now, this is called Volume 1, and the back cover teases that there's a Volume 2 coming. What is going to be in Volume 2?
Well, there's a ton of people I didn't get to, okay? And I admit, Volume 1 has gotten most of the big names, all right? But, you know, after I retired from the music industry, I went down to Hilton Head Island. I was 43, 44 years old. And I went down there to learn to play golf and to die at 50 like the rest of my friends, and I didn't die. But one of the things I learned, I was living among normal people for the first time in my life. Everyone that I met went home at 5:30, and dinner was at 6:30, you know. And Cheryl and I would be invited to dinner parties, and I would be this music guy who was suddenly on the island. And it was usually some top CEO would be having the party. We had a lot of affluent New Yorkers there, you know. And at the end, near the end of dinner, one of them would say, "Norbert, did you ever work with Jerry Jeff Walker?" Well, I hadn't considered Jerry Jeff in the first tier for Volume 1, you know. But as I told the story to this fellow, I had worked with him as a bass player. It was the highlight of this guy's life. It turned out that Jerry Jeff was his favorite artist of all time, okay? So in the second volume, I'm going to be covering a lot of people like the Pointer Sisters and Jerry Jeff and, I'd rather not say right now, but I've got about 12 stories outlined. And I'm also going to be speaking a little more about the problems that I had, that all the studio guys had, because we worked this horrible schedule, right? And our wives and our children wouldn't see us until the weekend. And it led to a divorce for me and most of my friends. It was not family friendly to have to work those hours. But, you know, once you made it into the top tier, you were expected to take those dates. And it was a horrible thing for our families.
Yeah, were there guys who could play but didn't have the temperament to get along in the studio? Did guys come and go?
Look, if a guy came into the studio with a bad attitude, we never saw him again. Word of mouth, by the end of that day, he would be on the road. He would be what we call a road musician. You know, a road musician, we would make the album with Bobby Goldsboro, I'd say, right? And he's got a band that will tour with him 6 months out of the year. He takes the record to his band, and they're usually younger, prettier, better-looking guys, okay? And they'll spend a month learning our parts and go out and play them flawlessly, right? The difference between the studio guy and the road guy, if he came into the studio, he wasn't likely to have a great part happening in 10 minutes. And the studio guys could just crank it out and blow you away. And so that was sort of the difference between us and those guys.
So when you're driving to the supermarket, what kind of music do you listen to in your car? What do you...
Well, this month it's been Arthur Rubinstein. I'm listening to the Chopin Preludes. And it's a wonderful recording on RCA. It was done, I think, around the late 1950s. And I don't listen to a lot of pop music anymore. I only listen when a friend of mine calls me and says, Norbert, have you heard this new production by this guy in Stockholm? Or, you know, and I'll go and grab the record. But I'm listening more as a producer and an engineer and just to see where the technology is. And by the way, I still follow all of that. And, you know, I'm recording my voice right now to send to you and very high quality digital as you speak to me on the telephone. So, see, I'll be 75 years old this year, and I'm still learning. I'm still studying Pro Tools, and it's great fun.
Have you got a something favorite we can play to end up something you've worked on over the years?
I'd just like to say this. Presley, okay? I loved Elvis Presley. He was the greatest singer I ever worked with. And when he died, I was devastated. Because I start to work with him in 1970. He's in flawless physical condition. He's a karate expert, not an ounce of fat on that body. And 3 years later, Priscilla leaves. And when we did the Stax sessions in 1973, it was the first time I noticed he'd started to develop a little weight, okay? And 4 years later, he's dead. He constantly was gaining weight up until 1976 I worked with him. I think at Graceland, and he was in horrible physical condition, but he could still sing. And 77 comes along. Of course, I'm busy doing Fogelberg and Buffett, and I'm having great success. And one day my phone rings at the office in Felton Jarvis. Hey, Norbert, we've been recording Elvis's live performances on multitrack. And he just did that old Righteous Brothers song, Unchained Melody, and the vocals great. He actually had never rehearsed it with a band. He just went over to the piano and said, Charlie, come hold the mic. I want to do this song. And he sat there and he did this great vocal, but he missed a couple of notes on the piano. Norbert, could you come down tomorrow morning? Bobby Ogden is coming to fix the piano part. And as soon as Bobby gets the piano part right, I want you to put a bass part on. And then Berg and White will write the Las Vegas band orchestra. Oh, okay. So I went down the next day. Ogden did a perfectly crafted piano part. And I played a bass part, and everything's out of tempo in the beginning. And you might want to play that as the final thing, because it was the last track I ever played on with Presley. 2 months later, I take my children to Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. And one day, I came back, and after playing golf, my wife said, could you run down to the general store in Honolulu and pick up a few things? I jump in my rental car, and they're playing an Elvis song. I hadn't been so happy in a long time. And as I went across that little bridge to Honolulu, I don't know if you've ever been there, Michael, but Honolulu is a tiny little town with a general store. They started another Elvis song. I made a mental note. When I get back, I'm calling the station and just congratulating that guy for playing Elvis. It's been so long since I'd heard it. I go in and I grab some milk, bread, a few staple items. I'm standing behind a hippie kid with a backpack who's camping out in the hills. He pays for his stuff and leans over to the cashier. He said, hey, do you hear about old Presley? And the cashier said, no, what? He checked out. I threw some money down, ran to the car with my food, and turned on the radio. And the announcer was saying, this morning at 4 a.m., Elvis Presley was found dead. And I don't know, that's a rather sad note to end your program on, but it's a great vocal. So, Michael, you decide, okay?
Well, we look forward to Volume 2, because like you said, there's, to me, some of the less known folks are the most interesting. It's been an amazing career for you, just the pop stuff, the country stuff, the stuff recorded in Alabama, the huge career as a producer, and also a guy who has a real reputation of being a nice guy, which counts for something, I think. But Norbert Putnam, it's been so interesting. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, and please mention that you can now buy the book on Amazon, which helps my people around the world, and you can buy it direct from me at norbertputnam.com.
Sure, absolutely.
And I have signed copies available at norbertputnam.com. Okay. Well, Michael, thank you for having me on.
Oh, my love, my darling, I've hungered for
Thank you.